I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In.
Today's guest, Tanya Marie Lerman, is an anthropologist of religion at Stanford University whose work focuses on the edge of human experience, hearing voices, having visions, the world of the supernatural, and the world of psychosis, whether on the streets of Chicago with homeless and psychotic women, with people who hear voices in India, Ghana, and Northern California, with evangelical Christians who seek to hear God speak back, with Zoroastrians seeking mystical dimensions, and with people who practice magic. She has written articles for the New York Times, as well as several books, including When God Talks Back, which was named a New York Times Notable Book of the Year and a Kirkus Reviews Best Book of the Year. Her most recent book, entitled How God Becomes Real, Kindling the Presence of Invisible Others, is the subject of today's interview. Tanya, welcome to Delving In.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with your particular interest in the experiential dimension of religion. How does this differ from other approaches, and how did you come to it?
I am interested in asking not so much why people believe what they believe, and more asking what is it people experience and what sort of inferences do they draw from their experience. If you start from the question of why do people believe what they believe, it's really an invitation to think why do they have a mistaken belief? Whereas, in fact, I'm interested in the ways in which people have vivid experiences, which really happen, and the way in which they come to understand those events.
So would a way to say that is that it's a descriptive rather than explanatory approach, and they bracket off the question as to whether or not what they're experiencing is real?
I wouldn't say that. It's certainly that I bracket off the question of whether what they're experiencing is real. But rather than coming to the puzzle of religion and asking, why do reasonable people believe in apparently unreasonable beliefs, I start with the presumption that belief commitments are about religion are different in kind from commitments about the everyday. And believers understand this deeply. So, for example, if I have this belief, the dog is in the kitchen, I go into the kitchen, there's no dog there, I change my belief. It's not a complicated thing. But if I assert Jesus Christ is alive and somebody says, no, that's not true, the person who utters that sentence is typically not likely to say, oh, you're right, I made a mistake. And it says somehow you hold those beliefs differently. And people who are faith practitioners know this perfectly well. They have a sense that they live in a matter-of-fact world and they believe in a God, but they don't believe in God in the way they want to believe in God. So people will say, we really want to think about God all the time. You should pray without ceasing. But in fact, when you talk to people, they tell you they keep forgetting to think about God, that they don't believe with a kind of certainty that they wish they could. And when you look at how people function in the world, you notice that people might tell you that God can do anything, but they don't presume that God can feed the dog. There are lots of ways in which the beliefs about a God are somehow cognitively different from other kinds of beliefs. There's something epistemically distinct.
One way to distinguish religion from science is that religious assertions are by their very nature unverifiable and also unfalsifiable.
Yes, I think some people might want to say that some science commitments also function a little bit like religious commitments. But what I would say instead is that they're just cognitively separate. People use different verbs to describe ideas about God and ideas about railway timetables. People treat their faith claims in a way that's closer to identity claims. I'm the kind of person who believes that Jesus Christ is still alive. They are more comfortable talking about the mystery of God than the mystery of when the Caltrain will come on Saturday morning to take you from Palo Alto to Stanford. There are lots of ways in which they're marked as different, and there are lots of ways in which faith claims seem impossible even to people of faith. Even people of faith, so many Christians will tell you that God is omniscient and omnipotent. God can do anything. God knows everything. And God loves you endlessly. And many Christians don't feel that's true for them in some way. They may not. They think that God is great, but maybe they don't really feel loved by God. They think that God can do everything. They also call the car mechanic when the car stops. So there's a way in which there's a set of ideas about a God, and there's also a sense, even for the faithful, that they don't really understand how that works. There's a set of puzzles. And one of the things that I see is that when people have experiences in which they feel the presence of an invisible being, it really helps them to feel that these faith ideas are somehow are more relevant, more important, more salient, more viscerally true. So there are a lot of people, for example, who will go to a church or a temple or some gathering, and they will announce that God is a certain way, but I don't feel it's viscerally true. That's the big thing about the love, that people will tell you that God is loving, but they don't feel it. They don't get it. They might not even know that they don't get it. It's just that they, it somehow feels emotionally cold to them. It's not something they feel badly. They feel like a bad person, like somebody. God doesn't love them because they're just bad. And so I think if you don't start with the idea that the belief is false, and therefore you're trying to figure out why people, you know, hold these false beliefs, but instead you start with the idea that the belief is pretty complicated and messy, and what you're really trying to understand is how God becomes real to people, then it's a sort of a truer reflection of the stumbling of that most people do when it comes to trying to make sense of what they think is true in the faith domain.
So it sounds like from what you're saying that more religious people than not are aspiring to have a closer sense of God's presence, and they're
absolutely
in a way disappointed or frustrated. And it's the rare person who is absolutely satisfied with the feeling that God is present all the time, or even some of the time.
The great mystics who are, you imagine, is in a constant state of bliss, in fact, are always talking about the fact that they're not close enough. It's a theme that runs through Teresa of Avila, Julian of Norwich, and they want to be closer. And the ordinary folks that I knew are always talking about the fact that they, if only they could feel closer. So there are all these manuals, like in Christianity, they're like thousands of manuals that teach you how to experience God, how to feel closer to God. Things like hearing God, God whispers, and there are all these, the purpose-driven life. Because purpose-driven life, Rick Warren's book sold more copies in hardback than any other book in the United States apart from the Bible. And this, the point of this book is to tell people who are mostly totally happy to tell you that they believe in God, how to feel that they really have a connection to God. Because people often feel that they don't, or they don't have as good a connection as they want.
And I would think that it could be even more frustrating to have a glimpse of a connection to God than to never have the glimpse, because if you have the glimpse, you want to recapture that glimpse.
And that's exactly what people sometimes say about intense spiritual experience. God gave me this, one man said to me. He had an amazing experience on the weekend of his conversion. He had something that people sometimes call a Holy Spirit experience. And he said, God gave me the whole cake that weekend. And ever since, he's only given me little pieces. And so that was frustrating for him. And I think, therefore, for some people, when they often that feeling that they've glimpsed God, there is this glimpse of intense happiness. Something like that amazing dream that you had when you were a kid and you woke up and you remember a tree on a green hill with a sword, and you've never had that dream again.
It reminds me a bit of the neuroscientist who had a TIA, or really severe temporary stroke, where her left brain was offline, so to speak, for a period of time, and she felt absolute bliss. She was living only in the part of her brain that sees everything and experiences everything all at once, and the part of the brain that deals with sequence and cause and effect and practical problems somehow disappeared temporarily, and she was just blissed out.
So those moments of intense certainty are often moments of an experience. You feel blissed out, you feel picked up and held, you feel commanded, and in the command you know that there is a God who has your interest in his heart. You feel invited, and those moments are really very powerful for people.
And very motivating, similar to when someone has a near-death experience and they experience heaven, or think they do. And I've had clients who had that, where they really felt that they had met God, in a sense, when they almost died. And that became the kind of the central organizing experience for the rest of their lives.
Those experiences in particular are often very powerful, because people really do see that they feel they have a glimpse of heaven. And then that can reorient to their whole understanding of who they are in the world.
So you talk about, you quote Gregory Bateson talking about the play frame versus the reality frame, and you also mentioned the paracosm, which I never was introduced to that word before your book. It was a very interesting word, a kind of a private but shared imagined world typically created by children, but in the case of religion, by adults. In fact, by adults more easily than children when it comes to religion, which is interesting. And how can we talk about paracosm without regarding religious belief and practice as childlike? Or is that okay to be childlike?
In some sense it is. I think that's so. I mean, I think that there's a lot about religion that is childlike. Right? People feel caught up, they feel engaged, they feel cared for, they feel free to elaborate and enter into this world. The key thing about gods and spirits is that you can't see them. And so to be committed to gods and spirits, you've got to be willing to hold in your mind the possibility that what you see in the world is not all there is in the world. And in order to get there, you need to somehow be able to walk into some bare building with a bunch of wood in it and think, oh my goodness, there's an animating spirit here. It's amazing and it loves me. And I want to be in relationship with it. And so you need to do something that's a little bit like playing, except that it's a serious play. You've got to be able to persuade yourself that this other thing that you must use your imagination to represent might actually be real. And one of the techniques people use is by knowing a set of stories, set of details about the beings in this other world. And that's one purpose of a text like the Bible. It gives you a lot of stories. And you share those stories with other people. You become, persuaded. When you've got a community, then you can talk about the Holy Spirit together. You're a little bit more likely to take seriously the possibility that it might exist. You're a little bit more, you've got to do something like suspending your matter-of-fact disbelief. You've got to do something, you've got to, about scientifically, about tables. Tables, there are a lot of molecules in tables, a lot of air in those molecules. You just have to persuade yourself that that's true, because mostly what you know concretely about, in an everyday way about tables, is that they are in the way you could sit at them. They support the weight of your body. You can stub your toe against them. They're just there. The stuff of religion tends not to be there in the same way. So you have to do something special to allow yourself to take seriously the possibility that it might be there.
Yeah, I guess one way that it's different from make-believe with children is that even pretty young children understand that make-believe is make-believe. It's not treated as real. And I think it's in your book, you quote a story where the child is feeding her teddy bear, and then an adult comes along and offers the teddy bear some food, and the child says, "It's only a pretend." The child knows.
Yeah, and kids do tend to distinguish between things that they're pretending, even when they're pretending very earnestly, and things that they take to be real. And what the adult person of faith, I think, mostly wants to do is to get themselves into a mode in which they are able to do something like switching into a play frame, except without that tag, this is play and pretend.
Exactly. And I appreciate your approach is very respectful of religion. I imagine it would be difficult to be an anthropologist of religion without that kind of respect. And otherwise, your subject matter could start to crumble, maybe. You cite Durkheim as saying that no human institution can survive if it rests upon a lie without which it could not exist.
That's what I mean by not starting with the presumption that religion is false. These ideas are stupid. You need to understand how smart people can hold ideas that are false. If you observe that people understand that these are different kinds of ideas, and then understand that what they've got to do is create the conditions through which they can come to feel more real, then I think that's a truer representation of what it feels like to be human and feels like to be a person of faith.
And then you also quote Kierkegaard as saying that prayer may not change God, but it changes the person who prays.
One of my contributions is to say that in order to enable you to hold the idea that these invisible things might actually be real, take some work. And that work changes the person who's doing the work. And so prayer, for example, you might think of prayer as it's really about asking for stuff, and it's really a mistake because maybe there's not a God and you're just saying a bunch of words with no effect. But if you look at what people are doing to put themselves in a position in which it might be realistic to think that there's something invisible present, You can also see the way that prayer changes the person who is engaged with it. Prayer asks you to shift your attention to what's good in your life rather than what's bad in your life. You're thanking God rather than whinging about something. You are trying to think about ways in which you have behaved badly to people. You are making a little goal about how you're going to behave better. And all of those are basically the skills of cognitive behavioral therapy. There's something very pragmatic that changes the person. I think you can also see change in just the content of the experience of praying actually changes the vividness of their inner minds, their mental imagery. You're using this capacity to imagine, to carry out a prayer, and that actually does help to make your inner world more vibrant. So it changes your experience.
We were talking about how the practice of religion changes the person. And one thing that you didn't mention yet, though I'm sure that you would, is it also leads to a focus on values, not just personal values, but collective values. And that seems like that would be a really important activity for a religious person to engage in.
You are imagining this community that you're a part of. And that is helping the more that you have this kind of shared imaginative space with somebody else, even if you're not treating it as imaginary, but as a space that you need to imagine. You also have a sense of belonging to this larger community.
What's really interesting about, there's a lot of things interesting about this, but one thing I'm thinking of is the word God or the word spirit or spiritual is so incredibly vague, and you can't get inside somebody else's head to know that they're thinking about this, whatever that is, the same way that you are. And yet there's a feeling of a collective appreciation of something.
I really became fascinated by the way people use the word God, because you could see, I remember dawning on me one day when I was sitting in Bible study. Everybody's using this word God as if they all understand what each other are saying. But in fact, they're actually thinking about different kinds of things in different kinds of ways. And that is it's very sobering to realize that people have different, almost visceral senses of who God is. People are trying to manage each other. So one of the things that you see people doing in a group like a Bible study is that somebody will say something about God. And if other people don't agree that is a godly example, they will, in fact, say, no, I don't think that sounds like God to me. And so they work to try to make sure that people are closer on the same page. And yet, I think there's a lot of variation. People put together a model of God from the people who love them and the people they know, and then the actual texture of what that inner being is, I think, is varied.
Then you have Jewish traditions that say that God is indescribable and unknowable and can only be discussed, can only be talked about in the negative, that God is not this and not that. And yet the tradition also goes on to give attributes to God anyway. So it seems like it's almost unavoidable, even when you aspire to a belief in a God that's so powerful and so amazing and so beyond understanding, we still have to try to understand God anyway, that God is kind or loving or all-knowing or has a plan for the unfolding of history and all these pretty human-like things.
People are very comfortable generating that kind of description, but by difference in texture, some people sort of dwell in the sense of being cuddled, and some people dwell in the sense that they will be punished if they don't do things the right way, and some people dwell on the expectation that one man told me that he thought that God would likely make him paraplegic. That's what and that was, I think, because he'd expected that of a parent. And sometimes when you get a group of people together, again, that they will try to manage somebody else's expectation of God. But it's like our inner experience of the people who love us. We can talk about our moms in the same way, but we have very different experiences of mothers.
You write something that might seem controversial. A capricious spirit who wreaks havoc with one's crops or boats feels more plausible than one who promises a perfect harvest. A judgmental God who punishes might seem more realistic, more in accord with the world as it is, than a God who promises eternal joy.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that it is more believable to think to believe in a sprite who's going to wreak havoc than a God who is eternally powerful and deeply kind. And a lot of people, I think most people don't really have experience of unconditional love. And so that's just it's a very sort of strange concept, something that is a being that is all powerful and all knowing and fundamentally good.
This really, I think, speaks to the need for people to have aspirations. And that through the practice of religion, they try to find their aspirations and fulfill them, and not be satisfied with the world as it is, but aspire to the world as it should be. And they can at least temporarily inhabit that kind of mindset of how the world ought to be.
Yeah, I think that is the remarkable feature about being human, is that we can imagine a world as it should be. We don't always agree with each other about what that world would be. But the idea that your job is to change the world seems to me a powerful human instinct, deeply embodied in our religious faiths.
So you, in your book, you talk about that we shouldn't assume that faith and belief come first, but rather that acts of prayer, devotion, and other practices come first, and then the belief comes second. And it's actually a passage in the Torah that talks about at Mount Sinai, all the people were assembled and hear God speak. And after hearing it, the people respond, Na'aseh v'nishma, we'll do and we'll hear. We'll do first and then we'll hear.
So the model I've been trying to build is this idea of kindling, that you, rather than starting with a belief and assuming that people are that belief determines what they experience and how what they do, really look at the way that people aspire to the belief, but their practices are what help them to have a more visceral, more salient sense that this invisible being matters in their life, that it's there for them. And so I see these things that over the course of my career I've seen play a role in whether people feel that a god or a spirit is really there. There's people pray, people do ritual, people do these, there's a structure of prayer practices in which people really pay attention to their inner world and their inner world becomes more vivid to them. If they share a kind of what I call a paracosm, a shared imaginative world, they participate in that world together. They're able to get absorbed in that inner world. They're more able to have experiences that give them a sense of confidence that this invisible being is there. And the community is really helping to shape their sense of who that being is and how that being wants to interact with them. And once people start to develop a sense that the being is interacting, then it's a lot easier to help people to feel bolder, to feel more as if this God is part of their lives.
So if I could just clarify for a minute what you're saying, it sounds like by committing yourself to some kind of religious practice, you can invoke not necessarily a feeling that God is present, but that God is important. But in terms of the frequency, it sounds like most people don't really get to experience a presence of God in a visceral way, but they can get to experience that the divine dimension is important and is involved in the life, in your life and in the community's life, that which is not exactly the same thing. It's a little bit removed from experiencing a presence per se.
Different faiths are different. So some people will expect in Judaism, there's a little bit more of an invitation to experience the presence of God in community. Christianity, there's a little bit more of an invitation to have a private experience of God. But I think that people are more, I think the belief is not as important as we think it is. I think that what matters for people is a sense of developing a sense over time of a way in which the whatever God is they understand to be there in their community feels real to them. And the realer it feels, the more they take the religion seriously, probably the more good it does in their lives. Religion is mixed. Not all religions are helpful for people, and not everybody interprets religions in helpful ways. But I think people actually have a bunch of experiences of the presence of God. It's not so uncommon. Most people aren't Teresa of Avila. They don't have extraordinary experiences, but many people have occasional experiences of the presence of God.
And of course, it depends on how it's defined. So a lot of people experience something of the divine when they see a beautiful sunset, or when they feel particularly close to another person, or they have a child, the child is born, and they kind of invoke that way of talking about it, that it feels like it's beyond ordinary experience, there's something extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. But I'm referring to moments where people say, God showed up. And they talk about a person-like presence who, like a person among people. And those are a lot less rare than you might imagine.
And then the community aspect of it seems like it ought to be quite central. I'm not sure it even makes sense to talk about a religion of one. If someone came up with their own personal religion, it would probably connect to something else. I don't know if someone could be completely original with it. And the fact that religion is used to bind communities and even sometimes bind whole countries, it has a kind of purpose to it beyond just the spiritual dimension, it seems to me.
Sure. That's something that Durkheim talked about as well. What I've really been trying to focus in on is the development of that visceral sense that an invisible being is present.
All right, so let's talk more about that, about how exactly do people invoke a divine presence, which I think is probably the core of your book, is how people do it in different ways, different cultures. And it's not all the same. How do they do it?
So I've seen, there's a lot to say, people are very complicated, but there are three factors that I have seen that facilitate the sense that an invisible being is present. One of them is whether you're, by temperament, whether you're able to get absorbed in your inner senses, whether you're the kind of person who gets lost in a book or gets lost in a piece of music, whether you love going for walks in the forest. So there's something about this capacity, this immersive orientation to the world, this experiential orientation to the world, which is really important and facilitates more these more vivid experiences of spirit.
This is a quality that also helps hypnotizability. That people who are good at hypnosis tend to be able to do that kind of absorption.
Yes. So there's a whole collection of names for this capacity to take what must be imagined more seriously. So hypnosis is that kind of word. Trance is that kind of word. Dissociation. So these are all words for the human capacity to enter into a memory or an imagination or a daydream and feel that there's something real about that experience that has to be imagined. Absorption is probably the broadest umbrella of all of those domains of capacity. So some people are people who are very highly hypnotizable, can really enter into an imagined state, and they behave as if they can't remember anything that's going on when they're, you know, around them, when they're in that state. But that's relatively rare to be highly hypnotizable. But these are, so there's this proclivity, this ability to enter into these sort of daydream-like states. And there's a skill practice, which is cultivating those states. And so that's the skill practice is the second factor that I see that helps people to experience gods and spirits as real. And there, it's when you look in different religious traditions, the skill factor probably involves two components. It involves a kind of as-if component. You are willing to suspend disbelief that this invisible, and take seriously the idea that this invisible being might be there. Because that, of course, the invisible being defies your senses, right? If you're looking, seeking a God, you can't experience God with your senses. So you've got to do something like suspend disbelief because your basic technique for grasping the world is your senses. The second dimension of this skill and practice is mental imagery cultivation or inner sense cultivation. So people are using their senses, their inner senses. So the famous example would be the Ignatian spiritual exercises. Kabbalah might be another kind of example where people are doing specific exercises. They're shutting their eyes. They're trying to look for, like Ignatius, he wanted you to retreat for a month and just live in the stories of the gospel and to feel that they were vividly present so that he cared more that the exercitant had a vivid experience than that the exercitant used their imagination in the way that Loyola or Ignatius thought was correct. For example, in the one of his exercises, he wants the exercitant, the practitioner, to imagine being with Mary and Joseph and the baby when they flee into Egypt. And so he's asking the exercitant, okay, now imagine the donkey, imagine what Joseph looks like, see the road, is the road a big open road or is it a narrow or closed road? So he's really trying to encourage you to imagine these experiences. You would find that practice also in shamanism, that people will seek to practice seeing in their mind's eye the different spirits they have to interact with and practice seeing the the soul of the ill people that they have to try to rescue. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is the way people imagine their minds. So it turns out that if people imagine that their minds are permeable, open to the world, they're more likely to have vivid experiences of spirit than if they imagine their minds as cut off from the material world by a concrete wall. This probably sounds pretty abstract. But if people imagine, so this is something that we discovered in doing our work, if people imagine the thought can be potent, that their inner world, that is potent, that it feels a little bit more substantial, then they're more likely to be the kind of person who can have vivid experiences of gods and spirits.
So we're talking about the various prerequisites in a way, or talents or propensities that a person would need to be able to invoke or practice invoking a divine presence. And I would think that another one might be just the need or desire for access to another dimension beyond what we ordinarily experience. That I think what you said earlier is that there's a feeling of that there's more to life or more to the world than what we can experience with our senses or through science, that this another dimension that maybe we experience after death, or maybe even when we're alive, and if we could just tap into it, our lives would be much richer.
So I think that, bluntly, if you believe that something is possible, it's more likely to take place, and so particularly in the religious domain. So if you believe that God can talk into your mind, or you believe that there is a God who can talk into your mind, you're more likely to have that experience. People have intense experiences, whether or not they believe in anything spiritual or supernatural. And so I'm really talking about these experiences that, or these dimensions of your experience that facilitate these experiences rather than prerequisite is a strong term, but for sure. If you have a set of expectations, if you have a set of practices, you think about your mind in a way that probably allows you to have some of these experiences, these more vivid experiences of gods and spirits, you're more likely to hear God speak to you, feel God place a thought in your mind, feel the wing trip of an angel, that kind of thing.
I would think ideally a person experiences, if they're looking for an experience of God, is that it's more than just being watched or observed, but there's more of a communication than that.
So when I ask people about these experiences, I'm interested in, have you ever been sent a vision by a God? Have you ever seen a vision that was given to you by God? Have you ever heard a voice in your mind or with your ears that you felt came from God? Have you ever experienced the presence of God as if God was standing near tangibly by your side? So we ask different numbers of questions, 18, 20 questions, about what we call spiritual presence events, moments when a spirit is present, which people judge typically because either the spirit's communicating or because they just have this vivid sense, though sometimes the way you have a sense that a person is there. And so they have something like hallucination like, but there's no sensory content to the experience. You feel that God is there.
And one of the examples you give about how that can happen is among American evangelicals in Northern California, if you have a really compelling reaction to a Bible passage, then somehow God is talking to you through that passage.
So there's a whole host of experiences that are sort of ordinary experiences that people are able to come to interpret as being the presence of God. So in this evangelical church where I was spending time, one of those experiences was feeling God talking back through the Bible. And what they meant by that, of course, everybody is a little different, but the experience they were hoping to draw out was not just reading the Bible and thinking about God. It was the experience that you're reading the Bible and you suddenly feel different. You feel a wave of exhaustion, or you feel a wave of relief, or you feel you have this emotional reaction. Oh my goodness, God meant me to read this because it's really changing my point of view. And so they begin to have a sense that this happens to people pretty regularly. And they, not all the time they're reading the Bible, but they're making this up maybe 50 times a year, where somebody's reading the Bible and it feels like God is really talking to them through this verse. And they begin to have this, they can begin to have the sense that, oh, that's a time. That's another time. That's another time. And meanwhile, they can be having these other experiences, like feeling that God has put a thought into their mind. It felt that this thought, it felt more spontaneous than most of their thoughts, or it felt, it stood out in some way. And they start to put together a picture, a model of who this God is for them. They have a history now. After a year, they've got a history of experiencing that God has spoken to them. So they're more confident that God is talking to them because they've had all these experiences. So they have more expectation that God will talk to them. They have more skill in looking for moments when God speaks to them. And as they develop more skill, they're also more likely to have more these sensorially vivid experiences, like they feel that God's spoken to them in a way they can hear with their ears. They felt, I touched them and they really felt his hand on their shoulders.
And it's interesting that in communities that experience these things, there's a, I think, a practice of comparing experiences among different practitioners and reinforcing the idea that not only is this possible, but there's a way of getting better and better at detecting when God is speaking through the scripture and when God isn't. And it reminds me a little bit about in Zen practice, thinking, you know, what's the difference between meditating by yourself at home and meditating in a group? You're not talking to each other anyway. And yet there's, a sense of reinforcement from the group that they're all doing the same kind of endeavor.
That's really what I mean by the paracosm. So you've got all these stories and you start to put together your community is telling you, okay, this is the kind of God that we have. This is what you do to experience God as talking to you. This is the way God talked to Abram. This is the way that God talked to Moses. People don't expect God to talk to them the way he talked to Moses, but they know that there were these moments when God was talking. And there's part of a group, and they have a sense of what God is saying to, God is saying this to me this weekend. And they might share that, and some people say, no, that's not God. But other people say, something like that happened to me too. And I remember being in a group once when somebody said, when the group was reading the story of the prodigal son, and which is a pretty dramatic story. The son, he leaves his father and brother behind, he goes off, he has an adventure, he nearly dies, he comes back, his father forgives him, it's a whole big deal, there's a huge feast. The other brother is miffed, but it's a big story. And in this conversation that we had, this woman said, oh yeah, that happened to me yesterday at work. And so obviously she wasn't referring to the whole big shebang of the story of the prodigal son, but she recognized herself in the story in some way. And so she tacks on this story onto something that happened at work. And now she's got this memory that God did something for her at work that she now knows took place. And she begins to weave that together. And the group, I said that nobody really understands what anybody else means by the concept of God, but it's also true that they share a lot of ideas about who a God should be.
So I'm wondering if we could digress just a little bit for this last segment and talk about the anthropologist Pascal Boyer, who talks about religious belief as a natural and expected consequence of normal cognitive brain processes. And the reason why we want to bring it up is because I think if what he says is true, then we ought to have respect for religion, even if you're an atheist, about just how natural it is to have religious belief, that in a sense, it's the default for humans, and that atheism, I'm not talking about whether it's valid or not, but just atheism would be not the default. It would be actually more difficult for a human brain.
So Pascal, I think his ideas are accurate. And he says, and there's some other people also who argue in this field, like Stuart Guthrie, Justin Barrett, and they argue that cognition, the way that human cognition has evolved, we see humans everywhere. We anthropomorphize. And the argument is that our ancestors were more likely to survive if they overinterpreted when a predator might be present or another human than if they underinterpreted. Here, the model is that there you are on the Serengeti, and if you hear rustling in the grasses, our ancestors who thought, oh my goodness, that rustling, it might be hiding a lion. Those ancestors are more likely to survive than the ancestors who correctly surmise that 99 times out of 100, it's just the wind. So the chances are good that it's just the wind. So those are the people who say it's just the wind. Those are the people who might have been eaten for lunch occasionally, because occasionally there is a predator. And or sometimes the predator is human, there with a knife, whatever. This school, which Pascal was instrumental in founding, has the idea that we hyperinterpret agency. We see faces everywhere. We see faces in the clouds. And because of this, the idea of a god or a spirit comes naturally. And I think that there's something really there. I see my work as contributing to the puzzle of why that idea of a god or a spirit is sustained. Because, again, if you hear a crash in the next room, you might leap to the idea that it's a person who's caused the crash, but you go to examine it, the wind blew something off the table, you decide that there's nothing there. So the missing piece, from my point of view, in the what's called the cognitive science of religion, is the idea that it's the puzzle of how these commitments are sustained in the face of the discovery that this other person is invisible. And we have also evolved to trust our senses. And the challenge of religion is that you have to override your senses.
Whereas before, not as much maybe, because what was perceived with the senses was in a way embellished by assumptions about agency. You quote Philippe Descola, talking about animism, is that animist worlds imagined human-like intentions throughout the world so that all objects had agency and were different merely in their appearances, which I think speaks to what you were just talking about.
Yeah, I think that humans are the same across time once you get to a certain point of cognitive evolution. So animism poses the same problem as Christianity. Christianity is a little harder to believe. So it's because of this claim of an omnipotent, omniscient, all-benevolent God. But all religions face the problem of invisible spirits.
Yeah, and I think it's anthropology, it seems to me, has done away with the idea that there's a hierarchy of religions.
I would agree that anthropologists no longer think of a hierarchy of religions. I do think that some gods are harder to believe in than others, and that these monotheistic gods require, and particularly the nicer the god is, the harder it is to believe in it, and which is why people do so much more work.
And yet these religions are the biggest in terms of numbers of adherents in the world. Not Judaism, but Christianity and Islam. Yeah.
Yeah. The work is often changes people's experience in ways that are positive for them.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the problem of the existence of evil. How do you have evil in a world where you have an all-good God? It's really requires maybe some mental gymnastics or theological gymnastics to make sense of it.
Yes, and all religions handle that problem in different ways.
Do you have a favorite for how that's handled?
No, I became very interested in Zoroastrianism because Zoroastrianism in one of its phases was pretty committed to a dualistic model of spiritual nature, so that there was a kind of a good spirit and a bad spirit, and neither spirit was omnipotent. And in one of its formulations, its Sasanian formulation, it seemed that the humans had to make the decision, had to participate in spirit in order to enable the good spirit to become dominant over the bad spirit. And that, I was always fascinated by that perspective.
Almost as if there's a almost evenly balanced, even balance between the two forces, and you need to join forces with the, to use a Star Wars expression, the good force in order to overcome the bad force.
That was this sort of Sasanian Zoroastrianism in which people did this text called the Bundahishan, in which it precisely describes that when we humans need to participate in order to enable the good spirit to conquer all. And I think it's really interesting. What's so interesting about that is that it frees humans from feeling that they are responsible for random acts of bad luck in their life. So you can experience yourself as attacked by, if you fall off your bicycle, you can experience yourself as attacked by this negative spirit, this Ahriman. Whereas in a religion that has this omnipotent model of God as good, you know, God knows everything, God is all powerful, and God is entirely good, then you have to do more, there are more conniptions to make sense of random bad luck. It's easier for people to feel, well, I was a bad person, so God knocked me off the bike.
Yeah, and then you have to invoke the idea that God knows more than you do, and that you just don't understand why the bad thing happened. It's for some future good, whether it's in the afterlife or this life, that it's part of some bigger picture that's impossible to see except from a divine perspective.
Everybody does that calculation a little differently. It was one of the fascinating things about individual religious orientations. People, that's part of what I mean by people holding different models of God. Some people make that calculation in ways that hold themselves very accountable, more accountable than other people.
And you also talk about different cultures characterizing the relationship with God in different ways. So God can be a protective parent or a comforting friend or what have you. The medieval poet, Persian poet Hafiz, describes God as a friend. That's his word for God, as friend, which is very, much less hierarchical, which is interesting.
So one of the things that's striking about the modern evangelical representation of God, particularly in these churches where people expect to have a vivid relationship with God, is that these churches were born in a moment in which they were afraid that Americans were unchurched. So they were presenting a God that they thought would be more comfortable for people, be more likely to attract them into the church. And that God is really quite a benevolent teddy bear of a God. And that's a very different God than, say, the Jonathan Edwards God, which is a very kind of fierce and difficult God. Or for that matter, the God of the Hebrew Bible is a very kind of fierce God.
Depending which part of the Bible you're looking at, yeah.
So Jack Miles makes a persuasive argument that God becomes kinder over the centuries. So you look at Yahweh's booting his children out of the garden and not behaving as a very kind God. The God that guides Moses' people through the desert, not a particularly kind God. Jack Miles makes the argument that if you read the Bible as a story, where you're not really supposed to do this, but he does it and it's brilliant. He says, if you just read those Hebrew Bible books in order, one of the things is that God speaks for the last time to Job, and then he shuts up. And what Job does, Miles argues, is to ask God a question of, like, why are you doing this? And God withdraws and to think.
And is still thinking. God is still thinking. This is an interesting insight to end on. I think we're out of time. So thank you so much for joining us. Tanya Lerman, an anthropologist of religion at Stanford University and the author of How God Becomes Real, Kindling the Presence of Invisible Others. Thank you so much. It's been really fascinating.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.